5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. And after the brief hiatus talking about the history of steam with Alex Masters, we're going to go back to keep on talking about Henry V and his famous 1415 campaign. If you remember last time, we left off right in the middle of the Siege of Harfleur. So I should continue talking all about that in almost day-to-day detail. Not quite day-to-day detail, but in quite a lot of detail. I should be reading largely quite a lot from a book, 1415, Henry V's Year of Glory by Ian Mortimer, famous historian Ian Mortimer. So let's continue straight back into the story. Mortimer says, quote, and we're talking about Saturday the 31st of August, 1415. Quote, at Harfleur, the bombardment continued. The siege was now 2 weeks old, and still there were few signs that the inhabitants were prepared to give up. That's interesting, isn't it? Because we're told that Henry had his cannons blasting away day and night, literally 24-7, and yet still the walls aren't pounded down or there's not a significant breach in the wall and the townspeople aren't prepared to give up yet. How do you square that circle? Well, there's a bombardment, a 24-7 bombardment, and then there's a early 15th century 24-7 bombardment. It's just not what you might think. You know, you might have in mind a World War One sort of bombardment. Well, it's just not that. You'd have one cannon firing every now and again. So it's very, very low intensity, relatively low intensity. You probably wouldn't like being on the receiving end of it, but it's not like a modern bombard. Some chronicles suggest that Raoul de Gaucourt had held negotiations with the English, offering to surrender the town. But these are equally likely to have been malicious rumours circulated in the wake of the defeat, when the various noble families in France all sought to blame each other for the failure to resist the English invasion. Just as likely to be true are the references to sorties from Harfleur as the inhabitants sought to carry the fight to the English. What is certain is that a third mine was commenced about this time in the hope of bringing the siege to a speedy end with no further destruction to the fabric of the town. It too was bound to fail, like the others. The approach to the centre of town from the Porte Lueur were now a broken mess of stone and timber, and yet still the inhabitants were determined to hold on. No matter what Henry threw at them, Raoul de Gaucourt and his fellow defenders held out, and they were in turn inflicting serious injuries on Henry's men. Thomas Hostel, a man-at-arms in Sir John Lumley's company, later recalled how at Harfleur he had been hit by a crossbow bolt, which had entered his head, destroying one eye and his cheek. Incredibly, he went on to fight at Agincourt. Just to let you know the time frames in this. Agincourt is in October. That's a terrible injury, that, though. To lose an eye, to have your sort of facial bones broken or shattered, and to lose an eye, and to not die in the early 15th century, it is remarkable to not die from that wound. And of course, there were no real painkillers. So, remarkable. Okay, Mortimer goes on. One cannot fault Henry's personal resolution in all this, nor that his brother Thomas, in commanding the second army on the eastern side of the town. The king continued to make nightly inspections of his lines, encouraging his men and making sure that watches were in place and the shift pattern for firing the guns was maintained. But several strategic miscalculations were now obvious. One had already been mentioned, that in order to bring about a swift end to the siege using guns, Henry was having to destroy the defences he hoped to gain. So he had miscalculated the determination of the townsmen. But another, worse problem was becoming apparent. His army was too big for its purpose. An army suitable for fighting a battle was far larger than the size of force one needed for a successful siege. He could not risk a full-scale attack, as he would lose too many men whom he would need later to fight the French army. But all the men with him needed food. They needed wine and ale. They needed money, and they needed clean accommodation. And although that last aspect might seem a minor one, it was actually very important. For now, another obstacle in Henry's path emerged, not from the defenders, but recognisable from the fetid, hot air of the drying, flooded valley north of the town and the ever-present effluent of 15,000 men camped in a small area with no sanitary provision. Dysentery. And so, disease. Whenever you have, I mean, dysentery is a bacterial thing, but still, any sort of disease, all the way up to the 19th century, all the way up to sort of the American Civil War, the Crimean War, men are more likely to die of disease than enemy fire in a war. And of course, that's the case back in the 15th century, when they had no real concept of the germ theory of disease, or no concept at all of it. You know, dysentery will be the start of it. If there's bodies lying around, you'll end up with much worse diseases. In long sieges, sometimes even things like plague can break out, but you might expect things like typhus, typhus fever, typhoid, various diseases. Like dysentery is somehow, amazingly, not even the worst of it. But okay, dysentery is no joke. It's obviously extremely unpleasant, but it's also a killer, can be a killer. In pre-modern times, like now, you shouldn't really die of it. You can, of course, but you shouldn't really. If you get the right fluids and the right medicines, you should survive. But once again, in the 15th century, easily die of it. Okay, Ian Mortimer continues now. We're on Sunday, the 1st of September, and we're told this, quote, "Explanations of how and why people fell ill were confused in 1415. Sometimes astrological predictions were put forward for contagious diseases, planetary alignment leading to a miasma or a polluted environment, which in turn led to pollutants entering the body through the pores of the skin and upsetting the balance of the four humours. Sometimes a miasma was associated with a particularly noxious smell. They all often thought, even up to like the 18th century, that bad smells caused disease. And this whole medieval idea of the four humours need to be in balance. Alternatively, diseases were attributed to God's will, either as punishment for a sinful act, as in the diseases heaped upon Henry IV for ordering the judicial murder of the Archbishop of York, or as a means of attaining redemption from such sins. In the latter case, God was supposed to have visited sufferings on people so that they might atone for their behaviour and, though dying an agonising death, repent by bearing it well and thereby enter paradise. In the case of dysentery, people realised that large camps of soldiers attracted diseases and that men chose to assemble large armies, so therefore the astrological explanation did not apply. Obviously, God's will did apply, and it could be understood that through disease, God sought to demonstrate to men that he did not approve of some sieges. In that sense, however much Henry claimed to be fighting a just war and acting as an agent of God's will, the appearance of dysentery in the camp could be seen as a sign that God did not, after all, approve of Henry's war or his cause. Those who were loyal to Henry therefore looked for other explanations and hit on other polluting factors. One contemporary chronicler, John Stretch, presumably writing on the basis of information sent back by combatants, pointed to the eating of unripe grapes and bad shellfish as the cause. Another writer, Thomas Walsingham, gave a vivid explanation of the causes of the stomach diseases and dysentery. He claimed, "These deaths were caused by eating fruit, the cold nights, and the fetid smell from the bodies of different animals that had been killed throughout the English lines, but which they had not covered with turf or soil, or had thrown into the waters of the river, so they were forced to endure their decaying stench." End quote. I mean, because in a sense, they're not wrong there. Lots of the diseases, it is dangerous and wrong to have rotting bodies and flesh around, even if they're animal bodies and flesh. They got it slightly wrong, thinking that it was the smell itself which was the dangerous thing. But, you know, they're not actually wrong. Little tip, if you are ever in some sort of survival situation and there are bodies, human or animal, around, do try to bury them or do something with them. Don't just leave them there. that would be quite dangerous, ultimately. Okay, Ian Mortimer continues saying this. Certainly the presence of rotting animals cannot have helped, especially considering it was an uncommonly hot summer. The 16-year-old Lord Fitzwalter, serving in the company of the Duke of Clarence, became one of the first casualties of the siege, dying on this day. Another factor contributing to the hardship of the besiegers was that they were beginning to run short of food. Although Henry had ordered that each man bring sufficient food for 3 months, in reality, supplies had only lasted 3 weeks. In London today, one Richard Boakland was ordered to provide 2 ships to convey victuals, food, basically, including fish, to the army of Harfleur. And over the next 2 days, 700 marks was assigned to Richard Whittingham to repay him for his expenses in maintaining the siege of Harfleur. The 2 men from Henley were ordered to provide 100 quarters of wheat for the king's household at the siege. So basically, we're beginning to see that Henry V's tactic, strategy of taking Harfleur quickly, a key tenet of his plan, it's not happening. It's not falling quickly. That's a problem. Mortimer again, quote, "For those in the town, things were even harder. They had even less food, could not sleep for the fear and the noise of the incessant destruction, and the waterborne diseases were beginning to spread within the town too. Knowing this, Henry set a herald about this time to invite Raoul de Gaucourt and the other leaders in Harfleur to discuss terms. They came under safe conduct to meet the king. Henry attempted with sweet words to persuade them to surrender the town. He had his title to the throne of France repeated to them too, and his claim to the Duchy of Normandy. But Henry had understood the townsmen's resolve. De Gaucourt insisted that the King of France would not leave the town to fend for itself for long, but would soon arrive with an army. So he refused Henry's invitation. Instead of surrendering, he sent a messenger to the Dauphin, urging that he send an army as soon as possible to relieve the town. The Dauphin left Paris this morning and journeyed to Saint-Denis, the royal abbey just north of the city. Here he prayed for victory. He also sent out letters to the Duke of Orléans and Burgundy, and the Count of Nevers, brother of John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, requiring each of them to send 500 men-at-arms and 300 archers. John the Fearless was requested not to come in person, but to send his son, Philip, Count of Charlois, in his place. This was no doubt intended to avoid the risk of the Duke leading an army that might suddenly turn and fight against the Dauphin on the side of the English. Nevertheless, John was bound to take offence." So the French beginning to muster in earnest. Okay, on to Tuesday the 3rd. Henry wrote a letter to the mayor and jurats of Bordeaux, telling them that he and his company were in the best of health, for which, in all humility, we give thanks to our Lord God the Almighty, hoping that by his grace he will give us, in pursuit of our right, the fulfilment of our desire and undertaking, to his pleasure and for the honour and comfort of us and you. With God's help, he said, the enemy would be less capable of doing harm to his Gascon subjects in future, alluding to the danger of Norman ships attacking the Gascon wine trade. He asked them to assist Sir John Tiptoff in guarding against any French assault in Gascony. As for himself, he stated he was in need of wine and other victuals, which he asked them to send straight away, promising payment in full on delivery. At the same time, Dr. Jean Bourdieu, Archdeacon of Medoc, who was with the king at Harfleur, wrote a more detailed letter to the Durade. He noted that the king himself had just written and gave much more detail regarding the real state of affairs at Harfleur. He stated that, although the fields were still providing the army with sufficient corn, they could not be expected to meet the future requirements of the army, especially as more men were coming from England every day. This alerts us to the fact that reinforcements were arriving, a fact that is supported by careful analysis of the accounts relating to some of the companies with Henry. Bourdieu mentioned that Henry had asked for more wine to be sent. In this respect, he specified that the king required between 500 and 700 tons, and he urged the townsmen to look to this with diligence, stating that Henry wished to come in person to Bordeaux before he returned to England. Bourdieu went on to say that, with the help of the Holy Spirit, he expected the town to fall within 8 days. This was because the defences on the landward side and on 2 flanks had now been well and truly breached. The town within the walls was totally destroyed. The English had now managed to cut off the water supply below Montivilliers, thereby diverting the river Lézard, draining the flooded area and cutting off the town's water supply. When the town finally fell, the king was not going to enter it, but stay in the fields, meaning he meant to continue his planned march through France. on this, Bourdieu was quite specific. He intends to go to Montivilliers and from there to Dieppe, afterwards to Rouen and then to Paris. Much of this was wishful thinking. Regardless of how long the town held out, it was now surrounded by thick, stinking mud, suffused with inedible fish and animal entrails, bones and excrement. It could only grow more dangerous, especially as the English troops had to trudge through it to get closer to the breach in the walls. The dysentery was not going to go away, and the town would require a substantial workforce to rebuild it as well as to maintain it, and the food was running out. About this time, Henry issued an order via his brother, the regent in England, to the constable of Dover Castle and the warden of the Cinque Ports, to send each and every fisherman with his boat and tackle to Harfleur, there to provide fish for the king's army. The chances of Henry marching on Paris in the near future were non-existent. The messenger who had left Harfleur 2 days earlier had travelled through the night to Paris and then on to Saint-Denis to convey de Gaucourt's plea for help to the Dauphin. At first, the Dauphin was reluctant to receive him, having other business to attend to, but after the urgency of the situation had been established, the messenger was granted an audience. He had left the Dauphin in no doubt as to the conditions in the town and pleaded for a relieving army. If none was forthcoming, then the town would soon have to surrender to the detriment of the throne of France. The Dauphin was able to say that a large army was already gathering. The summons of the 28th of August and the letters to the royal dukes of the 1st of September would result in a large force assembling at Rouen. If the town could hold out for a little while longer, the French would drive the English into the sea. There was just one problem. Henry had declared that, after he had taken Harfleur, he would march on to Rouen. We do not know if this news was publicly being circulated. It only appears in the letters sent to Bordeaux. But if the French did not know, then it would have soon become apparent that both sides were going to converge on the same town. Okay, Saturday the 7th of September. The letter from Richard Courtenay to Jean Foucault, carried by a Raoul Leguay and confiscated in Montivilliers, arrived in Paris yesterday. On receipt, Foucault was arrested and thrown into the prison known as the Little Châtelet. He was taken out today and led before the president of the Parlement, Jean de Valier, and charged with high treason. Poor Foucault had been duped by Courtenay. His presence in England that summer, coupled with the incriminating evidence supplied by Raoul Leguay, did not help his case. The old astrologer clockmaker must have been in fear of his life from the moment the men-at-arms knocked on the door. Tuesday the 10th. In Paris, the old king attended a solemn procession and mass in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, praying for victory with the help of God and the intercession of the saints. When this had finished, he travelled to the Abbey of Saint-Denis and there heard another mass. The relics of the patron saint were exhibited and the king was handed the sacred war banner of France, the Oriflamme, which he then passed to the similarly aged Guillaume Martel, Seigneur de Bacqueville. With that symbolic gesture, France was now at war. If the banner was unfurled on a battlefield, it was an instruction to the French to take no prisoners. Friday the 13th. Another messenger from de Gaucourt reached the Dauphin. This man was called Jovin Lescaut, and he had originally been smuggled out of the town in order to solicit aid from the constable, Charles d'Albret, who was then at Rouen. D'Albret had sent him with the Montjoy Herald to the Dauphin, who was at Vernon-sur-Seine. The message he delivered was similar to that of the early messenger, only more desperate. Again, the Dauphin promised that his father, the king, would soon be riding at the head of an army, but that is all he seems to have done directly to respond to the appeal for help. Sunday the 15th. A month and a day after the army landed in France, Bishop Courtenay died of dysentery, dehydrated and feverish, excreting bloody diarrhoea. Henry was with him in his tent when he passed away and closed his friend's eyes with his own hands. So this was God's judgment on him, his ambitions and his expedition. Henry knew that many people in the outside world would see it that way, and he had lost a great friend, which must have affected his thinking. His judgment was so askew that, wiping the feet of the dead man, he ordered that the bishop be taken to Westminster Abbey to be buried among the kings of England. It was not an appropriate resting place for a Bishop of Norwich, but Henry could not see that. Grief, worry and pressure were clouding his mind. The monks of Westminster did as they were asked, of course, but they could hardly refuse their king and patron. So the body of Bishop Richard Courtenay was taken to the royal sanctuary at Westminster Abbey and laid to rest. There it remains to this day in the same grave and in the same coffin as Henry V himself. Just when the king was at this low ebb, the men of Harfleur rallied to drag him down further. the watchmen and guards on the main barbican outside the Port Loire made a sally against the English guard and set fire to the English defences. From his position at Graville, Henry could have left Courtenay's tent to see the smoke of the burning faggots drifting down the valley and the enemy troops attacking his own soldiers. Later, inspecting the lines, he would perhaps have heard how the Frenchmen were shouting insults at the English for being so half awake and lazy. At about the same time, there were barges and galleys in the Seine attempting to break through the English maritime blockade of the town. There seems to have been an attempt to break out from the town, timed to coincide with an attack from the river. De Gaucourt's messengers to the Dauphin and Albrecht were not only getting information out of the town, but somehow they were getting information back in. So Henry's siege lines are far from secure. Although Henry had sent the ships from Flanders home long ago, he had also sent back many English ships. Those that remained with him held their defences, and when the sortie from Harfleur retreated, so too did the barges and galleys. At Southampton, in the wake of the Earl of Cambridge's plot, when Henry had been urged to cancel his expedition, which he obviously didn't do, he had shown the necessary resolve of a great leader. Others might have seen the death of a close friend, and a bishop at that, as a sign that God was against him. Henry seems to have seen it rather as a personal test. Through such sacrifices, he was being tempted to seek terms, or shelter, or retreat. But, of course, this was Henry V, and this is one part of the popular legend that is true. He would never give in. Tenacious in the extreme, this setback simply caused him to order an all-out attack on the barbican of the Port Loire the following day. In preparation for the assault, Henry ordered that faggots be prepared to fill in the defensive ditches in front of the barbican. This was done through the night. From references to his watchfulness at night, one gets the impression that as the man moved silently through the darkness, carrying the bundles of sticks, the king was watching, surveying, calculating and praying. So it's all or nothing for Henry. Henry is not going to give up. He's gambled everything. You know, as we said in the last episodes, the legitimacy of his reign, the legitimacy of his entire family to rule, the honour of England, everything's on the line. So even though he's had setbacks and it doesn't look good and his plan has kind of been, well, pretty much definitely been derailed, he's not going to Paris this year, whatever happens, really. He's not going to be able to claim the actual crown of France and be crowned at Rennes this year. None of that's happening, but he's not giving in. You know, nothing is over. No, he's not just going to run away with his tail between his legs. That is just not on the cards. So, well, you've got to give him that, if nothing else. He's got resolve. He's got trousers. He's a man with a chest. Okay, going on now to Monday the 16th of September. Quote, "It was Henry's 29th birthday. No celebrations were likely. All he wanted was revenge for the previous day's torments. The onslaught on the barbican in front of the Port Loire were led by the young and highly spirited John Holland, Earl of Huntingdon, supported by his father-in-law, Sir John Cornwale, and the newly knighted Sir William Poulter, as well as Sir Gilbert Umfraville, John Steward, and Sir William Bouchier. These were the same men who had commanded the first reconnaissance of the shore at Harfleur on landing, and so may have formed a recognised crack squadron within the English army. In the afternoon, a contingent of Frenchmen sallied out, trying to build on their success of the previous day. But Holland and his men met them head-on.
Work, work your thoughts, and in them see a siege. Behold the ordnance on their carriages, with fatal mouths gaping on girded Harfleur. Suppose the ambassador from the French comes back, tells Harry that the king does offer him Catherine, his daughter, and with her to dowry some petty and unprofitable dukedoms. The offer likes him not. And the nimble gunner, with linstock now, the devilish cannon touches, and down goes all before them!
Then, by shooting burning arrows, flinging torches, and laying incendiary powders, they managed to set enough of the barbican on fire to force the defenders back into the main gate. Amid the burning parts of the barbican, shattered by cannon, the first English troops entered and torched the rest of the defensive enclosure. Some Frenchmen were still there in the smoke, trying to beat down the flames. They were set upon by the English. Most realised their dire situation and fled inside the walls, blocking the entrance behind them with timber, stones, earth and dung. The English, having taken the barbican, now worked to put the fires out. It was a struggle. It took 2 days to extinguish the blaze. The smoke rose in thick, pungent wafts from the dung for another 2 weeks. So finally, some sort of battlefield success there for the English. Finally taking that very important outwork, the Barbican, the defensive position right near one of the main gates, or the main gate that Henry's attacking. So finally, something to actually show for, you can actually point to, saying, oh, well, we have done this now. We have taken this. Sometimes it's something like that, a bit of momentum, a slight momentum shift, a slight boost in morale for your side, and a slight reduction in morale in the enemy's side. These kinds of things can make differences in a siege, any sort of long siege.
If you'd like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Menards 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors. The bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover. And designing that outdoor space of your dreams. Save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check. Not a point of sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details. Save big.